All right, so last time,
as I erase all your clues. Well, good. So you should be able to tell me all about what we're doing, what it's about, multiple different ghosts we talked about, who wrote the book, C.S. Lewis, okay, what book is it?
The Great Divorce.
Yes, Clive Staples. We got it. Clive with a V. Like a chive, but with an L.
C-L-I-V.
Wow.
Never heard that.
Well, wouldn't you call yourself C.S. then, maybe, too?
Yes, I would.
All right, and he writes The Great Divorce. Okay, The Great Divorce. And tell me about what that means, The Great Divorce. It's a great divide, okay? A great separation. One and the other. And what is the separation between? Heaven and hell in the way it appears in the book, but what is it really about? He uses heaven and hell as a backdrop. And you remember last week, Jacob talked about a house, like a TV set. You go and you look at it, and it's not really all there. It's not really meant to be perfectly accurate. It's meant to give you the idea that you're in a house, right? So that television set house, or the one when we saw the Anne of Green Gables play, or the one where we saw Sound of Music play, right? It wasn't really a house, but what was it is meant to give you the impression when you change a setting of where you are. Because the setting is only about a few things, but it puts in your mind a picture of something. So what is that picture that they're putting, that Clive Staples is putting in your mind? If it's heaven and hell as a backdrop, okay, then I don't think... there is an obvious disconnect between heaven and hell, right? People for ages have said, well, heaven and hell is about as far apart as you can get, right? And in the Bible, we also know, Jesus illustrates it through a story from the rich man and Lazarus, that there's a great gulf that you can't get between the two, okay? A gulf is a great big separation. So heaven and hell, we know those are separated. But that's not what really C.S. Lewis is talking about. What is he talking about? Let's go down some of the examples, and then we'll come back to that. The big question mark. What is he talking about? Big question mark. Okay? What is he talking about? So, we meet a bunch of characters in there. Tell me about the characters. The guy with the lizard. He's one of the most memorable. And the guy with the lizard got, where is he? Where's the setting that he is? In. Okay, he's in the heaven setting. Does he belong there? Not when he starts, right? In that heaven setting, he doesn't belong there. And why doesn't he belong there?
Still has the lizard.
Got the lizard on his shoulder. And apparently people with red lizards do not belong in heaven. So if you have a red lizard, you should get rid of him, okay? No, that's... The point is not that he's in heaven or hell, really. The point is, what did he have to do to get rid of the lizard?
Kill it.
Endure pain.
Almost. There's a better start. He did not have to kill it. He had to endure pain, but what did he have to do before he endured pain? That's the biggest piece of it. He had to say what? Do it. And he made what in his mind before he did that?
A decision.
Perfect. A decision. So he made the decision as he is inside of heaven. But that really doesn't matter. He makes the decision to get rid of the lizard. So the lizard goes. He's gone. And once he's gone, he transforms, right? To a great man, flying horse, drew off the ride off in the sunset kind of thing. And that, as you recall, was temptation. That lizard was temptation. And it was allowed to have a place, not just on a leash, but on his shoulder, right next to the input for his brain. Okay? Directly plugged into his brain through his ear. Right? You can take in all kinds of information from your ear, and it goes right in through to your brain. But he made the decision, well, maybe I'll keep it. Maybe it's asleep. Okay? There were several other ghosts. Maybe we'll hit a couple more if you can think about them. There was a guy who killed somebody. And then there was a guy who was just mad. And you remember the guy who killed somebody was forgiven. And he said, what I did that was worse was I hated you my whole life. And the other guy said, well, you know, I've done the right thing. I didn't do all such bad things in my life. Okay? So, right here, we got the other guy who killed somebody. And then we got the guy who thinks he does right. Okay? Thinks he does right. And then we met another guy. He was a priest with gaiters on. If you remember, those are like sort of breeches, socks, kind of boot covery socks type things. Okay? He was a priest, and he was all about having an open mind. Gotta have an open mind. You can't tell me what to think. I'm gonna have an open mind on things. But in that very same thought of him saying, well, you can't tell me what to think, he got into a university. He went to a university, and he started to write all of his papers based on what the popular thought was, because he got better grades. He sort of plugged into the stream that was going by, the stream of thought. And you remember what happened at the end. The narrator, he decided he was going against the stream, right? Remember, he walked on top of the water, and as soon as he stepped on there, he fell flat on his face, bruised his face off. Okay? Because it's difficult to walk against the stream of thought. But the guy with the gaiters, he thought he was doing just fine, and he had his friend, I think Dick was his friend, and his friend he thought was narrow-minded because he stopped saying, well, I'll just take everything anybody puts into my brain and say, well, that's good because it's good modern thought. Just because it's popular thought or modern thought doesn't make it right thought. All right? And so we got that priestly guy. So we got all these different things. So if heaven or hell is not what it's about, and we're talking about a great separation, and we've got all these different people with different lifestyles, what do you think he's really talking about? I told you C.S. Lewis has an amazing way of stretching your mind. Because the very first thing that you always put about his books and you say, well, that's what he means, it's very rarely true. He actually is thinking on a much deeper level often. So many people, you'll find they'll write things about, well, C.S. Lewis said heaven is like this. C.S. Lewis said hell is like that. That's what he believed, because that's what it says in there. He's not talking about that. What he's talking about totally is what Camry said, your decision in your mind. You decide what you're going to be like. You decide in your life what you're going to do. You decide how you're going to act. Your brain power is either spent doing insignificant things in your life, like squishing bugs, or more significant things in your life, saying, I won't be like that person. I won't do that. I choose to walk a different path. I choose to take a different pathway. And so what that total separation is people's thought life. Your mind is the control tower for your body. There is nothing that you do that does not start in your mind. You thought it one time. You may have made a habit. And so you don't refer to your mind often with a habit. Sometimes I go to work, especially when I, now that I've gone to a new place, I don't do it as much yet. But after I was driving to the U of R for 15 years, there were many days that I woke up 45 minutes into my drive and said, boy, I don't remember anything I did for the last 45 minutes. Your mind goes almost comatose. I'm pretty sure I stopped at the stoplights, still alive, so I guess I made it through, but I don't recall. You can train your mind to just run down a track, and it'll do it forever. And if you let your mind go to what you're naturally good at and what you're naturally going to do for habits, they will not end up to be good ones. You may have a few good habits, but mark my words, you will find you have many more bad habits than you have good habits. And the bad thing about the bad habits is they are often the sneakiest things in your life. You'll find most of his characters felt they were doing good. Remember the guy, he said he was totally convinced in his own mind that he was doing right. And isn't that the right thing to do, be convinced in your own mind? Very subtle ways that you can walk down the wrong pathway. Very subtle. That's why you have to be a good thinker. You have to be a smart person to make it in this life and do the right thing. You have to be wise, more just than smart with knowledge. You have to understand the choices you make. Every character you meet in this book, and by the way, all these things are online. You can go back and listen to the last 5 or 6 weeks that we've been doing this. You can go back and look at all of them are all very subtle. Okay? You can listen to the fact that many of them believed totally that they were going to be in heaven, that they should get there, that they should be on their way. There's no reason why they couldn't. They believed what they had in their heart was real, or they were driven totally by emotion rather than making a choice along the way. You remember last week, there was a mother. And that mother had a big struggle with who?
Her son's death.
And so someone came up to her, one of the people from the background of heaven who have made the good choices, as opposed to the old gray town, okay, who didn't make good choices and kept getting further and further separated from other people and further closed in on themselves. She made those choices to say, well, I'm going to give up everything in my life for my son because he died. And on the outside, it appeared that she was being very loving and very kind. But after a while, she started to make her own pathway to say, I'm angry. And I don't care about the people that I have left on this earth. And her real motive was not love, but her real motive came down very subtly, but her real motive was that she was thinking of herself. See how it's very clever. And Satan is good at offering you up something that looks really believable. But in the end, it turns out often to be just based on your own thought, your own self. Very selfish. And he doesn't have to bait very much, usually, for us to take it. So that woman, the last week, was so angry, wanted nothing to do with anything, was so mad. She said, I just am mad at everybody. No one else could have loved my son like I loved my son. Really? Well, what about his father or his sister? Well, she said, well, they didn't love him as much because they didn't do this or they didn't do that. In the end, you find out it was a very selfish, self-centered motive she had. People often walk that pathway. They often do it. And like I said, it appears to be very spiritual even on the outside. And yet it may not be. Okay? So here's a very subtle one. We're going to meet a new character tonight. Two new characters, which are really three, but only two. It's kind of strange, okay? We meet a girl, and she is described as the most beautiful girl. Okay? Her name is Sarah. Sarah Smith. Sarah Smith. I think chosen to be a very plain name on purpose. Very common name. Okay? On purpose. So, I'm going to read to you a short excerpt about Sarah Smith. It should be fairly obvious when I read the choice and the decisions that she's made in her life. Okay? You're going to read about Sarah. We'll read, start here, about Sarah Smith. But I have forgotten, and only partly do I remember, the unbearable beauty of her face. Is it? Is it? I whispered to my guide. Not at all, said he. It's someone you've never heard of. Her name on earth was Sarah Smith, and she lived at Golders Green, whom you never heard of either. She seems to be, well, a person of particular importance, isn't she? Aye, she is one of the great ones. You have heard that fame in this country and fame on earth are two quite different things. And who are those gigantic people? Look! They're like emeralds who are dancing and throwing flowers before her. Haven't you read your Milton? 1,000 liveried angels lackey her. Now that's a very old, old way to say, here is this beautiful girl. And she has these spirits, angels, something, going all around her. They seem to shine like emeralds. And they're throwing flowers all around her wherever she goes. Pretty fantastic, okay? 1,000 liveried angels lackey her. In other words, they constantly follow and do everything for her, okay? That's from John Milton's Paradise Lost. And who are all these young men and women on each side? They are her sons and daughters. She must have had a very large family, sir. Every young man or boy that met her became her son. Now listen to this. This is important. Even if it was only the boy that brought the meat to her back door, every girl that met her was her daughter. Isn't that a bit hard on her, on their own parents? No, there are those that steal other people's children. But her motherhood was of a different kind. Those on whom it fell went back to their natural parents, loving them more. Few men looked on her without becoming, in a certain fashion, her lovers. But it was the kind of love that made them not less true, but truer to their own wives. And how? But hello, what are these animals? A cat, two cats, dozens of cats, and all those dogs. Why, I can't count them. And the birds and the horses, they are her beasts. Did she keep a sort of zoo? I mean, this is a bit too much. Every beast and bird that came to her had its place in her love. In her, they became themselves. And now the abundance of life she has in Christ from the Father flows over into them. I looked at my teacher in amazement. Yes, he said, it's like when you throw a stone into a pool and the concentric waves spread out further and further and further. Who knows where it will end? So this is Sarah Smith. She's a nobody. And he says, is it? He's trying to think of this grand lady who this is supposed to be. He's never seen anybody quite so beautiful. And he thinks this is Mary, the mother of Jesus. It must be. She's been portrayed in every art as this most beautiful, wonderful woman. And the guy says, nah, it's not her. This is just some lady you never heard of. But I'll tell you what she did in her life. Evidenced by all these people around her. The spirits with the glowing, throwing flowers. Okay? The little children everywhere. The animals all around her. This woman spent her life in such a way, not as to steal children. Okay? She's not trying to steal children. But what she had was an impact on every one of those. He talked about the drop. He dropped the stone in the pond, right? And the stone is very little, but there's concentric circles that ripple out for a long, long, long time, okay? And eventually, when you have an action, you take an action. That's your action right there. It's small, seemingly insignificant. But if your heart is in the right place, you're doing this thing for the Lord, and you're following God's will, that action's consequences flow out and out and out and out and touch people's lives again and again and again and again. And so her children, who are all around her, learned from her what it was to really love. You don't meet a lot of people in this life who understand love deeply. What it is to have a big heart. And I mean really truly a big heart. Where no matter who you bring to them, they have an openness. They have an immediate love for them. They care about them. You don't meet a lot of people like that who will take the time, no matter who you are, to stop, to talk with you, to say that little thing that means something to you, to create a relationship. As you do that, your impact for Christ ripples out and out and out and out. You could preach 1,000 sermons, and it will not make the impact of having just one good friend. You treat right. If you get 10 people that you can treat right, or 100 people, or 1,000 people that you can treat right, even just the butcher boy that runs to her back door, She treats him well. She cares about him. She says a kind word to him. And she makes sure she does because she thinks about him. And the guy's like, isn't she the most beautiful thing you've ever seen? Yes. And this woman has such a propensity to impact people that she can also impact a guy to be more faithful to his own wife. Now, that's not by being mean to him, and it's also not by being seductive, and it's not by being misleading. It's about being who she is and standing up and doing right. Okay? She has the ability and had the ability in her life to impact many. You're getting the picture of who she is. Now, I'm not saying this woman was perfect, and we'll find out she wasn't. Okay? We will find out she was not a perfect person whatsoever. But the impact she decided to make by all the people that she touched in her life, every person sitting next to her, whether they were treated well by others or not, she decided to make an impact. So the ripple effect carried on through heaven with eternal consequences. Okay? She made that impact and it was there. Now, we're going to see another character, totally different. Before we do that, I want to take you to a couple of verses to talk about that impact. Ecclesiastes chapter number 11, written by Solomon. Ecclesiastes, the wisest man in the world, Solomon was, and he messed up royally in his life. Okay? But this book was written near the end of his life, and he realized and he saw what was important in life. He wrote 12 chapters that talked about a lot of the things we waste time in life on, and then on some of the things that we can make a real impact on. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse number 1, 2, 3, and 4, please. Nice and loud. You have a really important one, so make sure you get it right.
Okay. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days.
Give a serving to 7 and also to 8, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth.
If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth, whether it falls to the south or to the north, and the place where it falls, there it will lie. He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the plough shall not reap.
Okay. First, talk about the bread. What good is it, and why would you throw bread on water?
Love something, wanted to get soggy.
You wanted to get soggy? Okay, right. Does it seem like a waste to take bread and throw it on? Okay, so you might feed some fish. Okay, right? Maybe not. Maybe it'll sink the fish to the bottom. So, you throw a lot on there, and you might make a little impact. It seems like. You could keep the bread and eat it. Maybe that seems like a better option sometimes. You know, why would I just throw it on the water? That's kind of waste. But what Solomon is saying is what appears often to be a waste when you throw your bread out on the water. I'm going along, throwing maybe a duck goes and grabs a little bit, and a fish goes and grabs a little bit, something like that. Your impact could be an amazing impact that you will never see. And it will be. And he says, it will come back to you. Now that doesn't mean that floating back with these soggy bits of bread coming back to you. What it means is, the impact you make, where you do it, it will come back and it will be important. And he talks about clouds. He says the clouds are full. You can't have a great big full cloud on a hot, dry summer day
and the cloud is full of rain, and it says, nope, not giving you a drop. If you're a full cloud, he says, rain. Rain on people. Don't try to force a tree to fall some other way. Wherever it falls, there it is. And there used to be rules, okay, about gathering wood in the king's forests, and that went on in many, many different places. Back in the Middle Ages, there was a phrase that came about that was by hook or by crook. Okay? And by hook or by crook started out in that all the peasants could go on the king's land in the king's woods, because the king owned all the woods, right? I own it all, you work for me, and you pay me. And that's how that works, right? I'm the king, and I'm in charge. So I own it all. Now, they're all starving and dying because they have no way to heat their house. So he's, okay, you can go in my woods and pick up the sticks on the ground. Anything that falls on the ground, you can have it. And then after a while, the woods are all clean, there's nothing left. And so he said, okay, by hook or by crook, you can get it. If you take a shepherd's staff and can pull a branch down, you can have it. That's why by hook or by crook comes about, okay? So you use something to pull it down to get it. But when a tree fell, and it fell onto somebody else's property or fell down one way or another, first person to get it, it's yours. So don't be caught pushing it over, but as soon as it falls, make sure you're there, right? Where things fall in your life, allow the impact to be made. Okay? Allow that impact to be made. That's the important part. And he says, if you're always looking for the perfect way to do it, he says, if I go out today and, well, it's a little rainy today. This is verse number 4. If I go out today, it's a little rainy today, or it's a little windy today, and I say, I better not sow my seed today because the wind will blow it away. And then tomorrow, it's a little wet today. I better not sow it today. Too muddy. And then the next day, there's another reason why. And the next day, you'll never sow it. You'll never put your seed in the ground, and you'll never grow anything. So he says, don't look for excuses when you're going to make an impact on somebody. Just do it. Okay? Just do it. It says, we won't turn there for sake of time, but in Titus chapter 2, verses 3 through 5, it talks about making an impact as a woman in particular. And I call up that verse because she's a woman, Sarah Smith here, okay? She's a woman, she's made an impact on all the people around her. And it talks about taking the wisdom that you have and sharing it with others around you. Being a kind person. Investing in other people. Okay? Making sure you put your impact out there. Okay? So this is Sarah. We got Sarah down pretty good. Now let's go on to the next character. And I'm going to draw him very poorly. But just so you get an idea what this is kind of about. There's a guy. He's thin. He's wispy. And he's got a hat. Okay? Tall and thin and wispy. There's a chain that he has. And the chain goes down to a little dwarf. Okay? Two guys chained together. One's real tall and thin. The other one's real short, tiny. Okay? This is the character, which really has two names and two people, but it's one person. And I'll show you how this works. He refers to the tall and thin, wispy guy as the tragedian.
Now, that's not a name that you probably have used very much in your life, okay? A person who does acting. Okay? They would do a tragedy. You ever seen the traditional acting signs? There are two faces, two masks, and one smiling and one sad, right? That's the traditional acting symbol. And they can call it a comedy of errors, okay, where there's funny parts and sad parts. Well, this guy, and there were certain people who are good at acting tragedy and certain people who are good at acting comedy. This guy is a tragedy actor. He's good at making sour faces. He's good at convincing other people. He's good at letting you know what his feelings are. And they're always sad. And they're always angry. And they're always hurt. And they really just can't believe you did that to them. That's the tragedian. The dwarf, as he's called, his name's Frank. Okay? All right. So as he walks up to this guy, whom he really sees kind of as two individuals to begin with, he walks up to this guy, and he looks at the guy, and he says, there's this chain between them, and the guy has, this tall guy has got the little guy like a little monkey on a chain. That's what he thinks at first. But as he gets closer, he realizes that it's not the tall guy who has the little guy on a chain, but the little guy is holding the tall guy, and there's actually a collar around the tall guy's neck. So the tragedian has a chain around his neck, and the little tiny guy is leading him around. Okay? Important to think about. Now, this is where C.S. Lewis is masterful at understanding relationships, and he's really masterful at doing analogies. Because you now have painted in your mind this really strange picture of Frank and a tragedian, this actor that acts about only sad and horrible things. He specializes in tragic roles, okay? And then you come up, in walks Sarah Smith, who is a vision of beauty with all this amazing life existing all around her, walks up to Frank and the tragedian. Okay? What you will find is that Sarah Smith is addressing Frank Smith because they were married on Earth. Okay? Now, apparently, Frank and the tragedian had gotten on the bus, gotten off the bus, and they're here to sort of evaluate their decisions in life, or get a chance, at least, of what it appears to be. The backdrop is he's getting a chance, but he's evaluating his decisions in life. Sarah comes up to him, and the narrator now listens in. All right. As I read from The Great Divorce about Sarah and the poor dwarf, or Frank. On the poor dwarf, she turned her eyes. Love shone not from her face only, but from all of her limbs. As it were, some liquid in which she had just been bathing. Then, to my dismay, she came nearer, and she stooped down and kissed the dwarf. It made one shudder to see her in such close contact with that cold, damp, shrunken thing. But she did not shudder. Frank, she said, before anything else, forgive me. For all I ever did wrong and for all I did not do right since the first day we met, I ask your pardon. I looked properly at the dwarf for the first time now, or perhaps when he received her kiss, he became a little more visible. One could just make out a sort of face he must have had when he was a man. A little oval freckled face with a weak chin and a tiny wisp of unsuccessful mustache. He gave her a glance, not a full look. He was watching the tragedian out of the corner of his eyes. Then he gave a jerk to the chain. It was the tragedian, not he, who answered the lady. "There, there," said the tragedian. "We'll say no more about it. We all make mistakes." With the words, there came over his features a ghastly contortion, with which I think was meant for an indulgently playful smile. "We'll say no more," he continued. "It's not myself I'm thinking about. It's you." "That is what has been continually on my mind all these years, the thought of you. You here alone, breaking your heart about me." You get the tragedy, okay? He's not really sad about her. He is playing a role. The little man who should have talked to Sarah wouldn't do it. And what did he do? Jerked on the chain. You do it. You talk to her. So think about that for a moment. Back to the book. "But now," said the lady to the dwarf, you can set all that aside. Never think like that again. It's all over." Her beauty brightened so I could hardly see anything else. And under the sweet compulsion, the dwarf really looked at her for the first time. For a second, I thought he was growing more like a man. He opened his mouth. He himself was going to speak this time. But oh, the disappointment when the words came. "You missed me?" he croaked in a small, bleeding voice. Yet even then, she was not taken aback. Still, the love and courtesy flowed from her. "Dear boy, you will understand about that very soon," she said. "But today, what happened next gave me a shock." The dwarf and the tragedian spoke in unison, not to her, but to one another. "You'll notice," they warned one another, "she hasn't answered our question." I realized then that they were one person, or rather that both were the remains of what had once been one person. The dwarf again rattled the chain. "You missed me?" said the tragedian to the lady, throwing a dreadful theatrical tremor into his voice. "Dear friend," said the lady, still attending exclusively to the dwarf, "you may be happy about that and about everything else. Forget all about it forever." Okay? Now, there's some subtle things in there, and you have to be a good reader to pick out things. Who is Sarah talking to the whole time?
Frank.
Frank. She refuses to talk to the tragedian. She won't talk to him. Why not?
Wait.
She's what?
He's fake.
He's fake. Okay. That's a piece of it. Could be.
Frank's the real deal.
Well, sort of. Not really the real deal, but... he's in control. Now, notice that. What does he do every time he jerks the chain? What's he doing?
He makes a dude talk.
Mm-hmm. So by Frank's choice, he talks to her through this guy, the tragedian, all the time. She almost gets through to him once or twice. He looks at her once and then kind of looks away. All right? But she doesn't quite get through to him. And every time he pulls the chain, you talk to her. I'm not talking to her. You talk to her. Now, this is where C.S. Lewis again develops an amazing thing, because then they have a little conversation with themselves. How many of you have ever had a battle with yourself in your own mind? Me, I have. Yep. You try to talk to yourself about something, maybe not aloud, or maybe you do talk aloud. I do sometimes. You battle with something in your mind saying, I shouldn't do that, or I'm going to do that. I'm not going to do this. I can't believe I thought that way. I should do this. I should have thought that way. Back and forth, the battle goes. Okay? Understand that the tragedy is there totally by Frank's choice. He put him there. He controls him. And he chooses to speak through him every time. He has created the relationship which Sarah doesn't want anymore. Now, I think on Earth, Sarah responded to the tragedian often. She didn't know enough to separate it out. But once she's gotten to heaven, she says, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to Frank, the little guy. I want him. I'm interested, yes, in the real deal, okay? I'm interested in the guy I married, not in the way he has been talking to me, not in the way he has been communicating with me for all these years. Because somewhere under there is that little guy. He's littler than the tragedian, because he's allowed the tragedian to grow. He's allowed the tragedy to be there. All right? Now let's make a connection. What is the tragedy? It's not a person you have on a chain with you. Okay? If Frank was standing here in this life as a character, he looks like you and me. Maybe, with a wispy mustache, I don't know. Okay? He looks like you and me, just a person. Is the tragedian with him? All the time. Most all the time. So what is he?
A mask,
in a way, yeah.
Stubborn.
Could be. What does he do? How does he act? Okay, so he always plays a role of tragedy in life. He always plays, I'm the one that has the worst life ever. Self-pity, there we go. We're right down the right track now. Self-pity, okay? And that's what Frank feels for himself. And so how does he communicate to others? How does he use his self-pity? How does he use the tragedy? Look back to Sarah, what's he do? He manipulates her. There's the word. He manipulates her. If you have ever had relationships with people, family, schools, teachers, leaders, friends, somewhere along the line you've run into somebody who has a manipulating relationship with you, or tries to. Now, what's important about how Sarah deals with it? She won't talk to it. She only talks to Frank. Because somewhere under there is that little Frank. He's pretty little. But you can find him. And she won't address the manipulation. She will not address the, oh, I'm so this. My life is so bad. I can't believe it. Did you see what they did to me? You might know somebody like that. Somebody that manipulates. And what they try to do is to get you to do things for them. It's very subtle. It's very subtle. And it's also very selfish. Because it appears to be that they have a sad, maybe even holy life. Lots of people use it. But really underneath, they're saying, I want you to do for me what I want. I want my own way, and I will stamp and cry and scream until I get it. Except what happens is adults get a little tiny bit smarter. Okay? When you're 1 year old, maybe not even 1 year old, okay? Let's start when you're a baby, and you have a temper tantrum. You cry when you want something. And usually we say, okay, give the kid a bottle, change his diaper, put him to bed. When you're 3 years old and you have a temper tantrum, now we're cutting on the edge of maybe you're just spoiled. When you're 5 or 6 years old and you have a temper tantrum, most people got your number by then. When you're 30 and you have a temper tantrum, everybody knows and says, whoa, I'm not going to be your friend. And so it has to be a much more subtle way that people do it. So people put on the tragedy. They put on the manipulation. The sorrow. My life is so bad. Be my friend. No one else is my friend. No one does this for me. It's so bad. My life. I can't believe what they did to me at the grocery store today. Can you believe what they did to me at the grocery store? I can't believe what they did to me at the grocery store. And on it goes, and it never ends. It is a constant manipulation. They're looking for your pity. But really what they're looking for is to get you to do what they want. And temper tantrums, they've outgrown them. Right? Can't do that anymore because everybody says, whoa, grow up and get a life. But manipulation is much more subtle because somewhere under there you say, well, maybe, you know, I've had hard days like that. I've gone to the doctor's office and it's been bad. Or I've gone to work and had those hard days. And maybe I could just listen to his story a little more. But it never ends. They start and they get you. And then they pull you in a little more. And they start and they pull you in a little more. And they use that manipulation to get you to do what they want. Very subtle. Very clever. But if you think of it like the big tragedian, the guy on the chain, that's not who you want to talk to. You want to talk to Frank, the little guy. The little tiny guy. It's wrong to manipulate people for your own purposes. It's wrong to use your clever abilities, acting as it might be, or whatever, to take and twist people's good nature into helping you. Okay? And it's subtle. And believe me, it's everywhere. It's in a lot of places. It looks stupid when you have this big guy chained to a little guy, right? And you're like, that's obvious. He's just talking to Frank. But when all they ever do is talk through the manipulation, just jerk the chain, and every once in a while, they have a little conversation amongst themselves. I can't believe she didn't fall for that. Next time, you better lay it on a little thicker. Okay? Next time, twist her arm a little more. She'll feel bad. She'll do what I want to do. You get to work. Jerk the chain again. Okay? Galatians 5:1. Where we have to go to. Galatians chapter 5, verse number 1. I'm going to pick that up where we left off, please. Chapter 5, verse 1.
Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free. Be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage.
Okay. Here is the important thing. People that use manipulation often in their life create a burden on other people. It's an emotional burden. Could be a physical burden. It can be a spiritual burden. Some pastors manipulate people. Some leaders manipulate people. Some bosses manipulate people. Some mothers manipulate people. Some fathers manipulate people. Some uncles and grandfathers and grandmothers. Some children manipulate their parents. All of those things used in this way are wrong. When you know Christ, he says, you stand fast in liberty. Stand fast because he's, I have freed you from this. You have freedom. You do not have to be under a yoke of bondage. And when you get stuck in that relationship with a person, an unhealthy relationship, and where they manipulate you, it becomes like you're put on one of those big oxen yokes. You're carrying the weight for them. And that's unhealthy for you. And it's unhealthy for them. God says, you got freedom. I gave you freedom. Notice Sarah, when she talks with him, she just ignores it. She goes right to the core of the person he is and talks to him. And says, you can stop this, Frank. You don't need to do this. It's not about this anymore. I want to help you, Frank. I don't want you to be this person anymore. You manipulated me. And she didn't say it in such a way to say, you manipulated me for 30 years or 50 years, and I can't believe you ruined my life. Instead, she says, you can stop this. Because really, that's a loving way to approach him. And that's how Sarah approaches Frank. In a loving way. Always putting aside the big tragedy guy. And saying, I'm talking to you, Frank. All right? I'm talking to you. You are free to live outside of that. You do not have to be manipulated. And oftentimes, when we're nice people, we try to do the right thing for people, some people take advantage of that and use that to manipulate you. Okay? To get you to do things. To get you to feel a certain way when you do something. That's not loving. That is not loving. I'm not saying that a person who has manipulation or uses manipulation sometimes doesn't love you at all. I'm not saying that. But when they use manipulation to get you to do something, that is not a loving act. Okay? It's not. Nor is it healthy. But you have freedom when you do that. Okay? Now, if we turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11... 2 Corinthians, just back a couple of pages. Chapter 11. We talk about bondage. There's a few things people can do to manipulate. Chapter 11, verse number 20. If you want to pick up where we left off there, read verse 20, please.
For ye suffer if a man bring you into bondage, if a man defore you, if a man take of you, if a man exalt himself, if a man smite you on the face.
All right. So we have a few things that people do to manipulate people. Okay, there's a few ways that people do it. Sometimes they get you in a situation, all right? A situation where you feel bad or they're trying to use you and they manipulate you. That's called blackmail, okay? Sometimes that situation comes up in life. They know something about you. They try to use that against you. They say, oh, if people knew about this, they wouldn't like you. But I'll keep it a secret. All right, and so that blackmail, that's the way that people manipulate. And then you have, if a man bring you in, okay, if you suffer, in other words, if you're treated poorly, just treat you poorly, that's a way. If they put you in a situation where they can blackmail you, that's another way. If a man devours you, in other words, they use you up, they get you to do things for them, and they suck up your time, your energy, your effort, your personality, your being. There's lots of ways people manipulate, okay? They soak you up. They soak you up, and they use you, okay? They use you. It's very subtle. Very tricky. All right. If a man take of you, in other words, get things from you. I'm going to get things from you. I'm going to manipulate you and get things from you. All right. If he exalts himself, in other words, he's always saying, look at how good I am. A relationship is not about always saying, I'm good. You should see that. A relationship, any kind of relationship, it needs to go back and forth and care about each other. That person can ask and say, hey, how are you doing today? I'd like to know what you did. I'd like to know what was important to you. What are you feeling right now? What are you thinking about? Not, look at me. Look how good I am. Let me show you how good I am. That's another form of manipulation. To constantly be pushing back in to look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. I'm more important, or exalting myself. Okay? And then the last one, if a man smites you on the face. Sometimes people use physical harm, physical abuse. Abuse in families, physical abuse in families is about manipulation. It is about gaining power over someone, control. None of those things are healthy. None of those things are right. Okay? So people have that ability to do that. People have that ability. Remember, in those cases, you have freedom. You have freedom. You don't have to talk to the tragedian. You talk to Frank. Now, something you should know as interest. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse number 7, it says, God has not given us a spirit of fear, okay, but of power and of love and a sound mind. And that's how you work with a person like this. Sarah is constantly saying, you're not seeing things clearly. There's her sound mind. You don't have control over me. There's her power. And I care about you, Frank. There's her love. Doesn't have to be manipulated. Doesn't have to fear this whole situation. She's free. Okay? She's free. Power, love, and a sound mind. That comes from 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. All right? Now, what you should know, as we finish up the last thing, you should know what happens to Frank. As she speaks to him, he continually makes his choice. Jerks on the chain. Jerks on the chain. Jerks on the chain. He will not talk to her. One time he almost did, but instead he talks to the tragedian. Okay? Jerks on the chain. After a little while, the tall, thin man becomes a little wispier and a little wispier. But not so noticeable as Frank. Frank, who started out as a dwarf, and the one time when she kissed him on the head, looked like he grew a little bit. Looked like he was a little clearer to see. Every time he jerked on the chain, he became a little smaller. So pretty soon, he was hanging on the chain. Little tiny guy. Hanging on the chain. And then pretty soon, they said, I couldn't see if he was there or not anymore. I couldn't see if it was, he was the size of a bug or completely gone. Don't know. Seemed to just vanish at some point. When you choose to live a lifestyle of manipulation, eventually, it becomes less and less and less of you, the little Frank. Less and less and less of you. And more of that personality and that lifestyle. You want to use it, you use it. And you shrink and you shrink. Who you really are shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. Okay? It's a sad end for Frank. Who disappears because he's lost everything. He had the chance to listen to Sarah. How many people did Sarah impact in her life? Tons all around her. Frank could have been one of those ones. He could have listened. He could have had the impact. But he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't listen. And he wouldn't talk to her. He kept using manipulation back and forth. Back and forth. Every time. And every time, only he lost in the end. Alright? Subtle thing. One of the characters in here. And you see how clever it is. But I hope the picture is clear of what the truth is about how it reacts. How when you use manipulation, a relationship is. It's like the guy with the chain. Okay? Understand there's a healthy way to deal with that. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good night.